This is Mark Strassman, reporter with Etopia Media. We're about to speak to Dan Bednarz, PhD, a former associate director of the Center for Public Health Practice at the University of Pittsburgh Graduate School of Public Health until 2005, and now a principal with Energy and Healthcare Consultants. Welcome to Etopia Media.
Well, thank you, Mark. Nice to speak with you.
Essentially, we're going to talk about the intersection of three things, peak oil, healthcare, and institutional inertia. Maybe you could briefly give our listeners your take on each of those three subjects.
Well, peak oil is going to change a lot of institutional inertia, as an opening statement.
Tell our new listeners what peak oil refers to.
It refers to the point at which half of all the recoverable petroleum in the world has been extracted, and then from there, so that's the top of the peak. And then from there, in other words, you start at zero, you go up to the halfway point, and the peak is the halfway point, and from there, it dwindles until there's nothing more to be recovered.
And why is that important in comparison to when the last drop is pumped?
Well, because and I'm glad you asked that, because I stress this to everyone I talk to, the really important thing is not if we're at peak oil. The important thing is the disparity, the gap between supply and demand. And right now the world is at the point, even some financial people are willing to say this, that we're at the point now where there is no spare capacity. Typically you have about 1 to 2 million barrels out there sort of floating around for sale, and now there is virtually nothing extra for sale. And that's why fundamentally, that's why prices are going up.
While we're at that point, maybe you could address something that just occurred to me in the last day or so. ExxonMobil made $10 billion in the last quarter, and essentially they say they're just passing through the higher world oil price. But if that's true, why are they making more money than they used to?
Well, the cost of the product is higher. That's one answer.
You mean the price that they're selling it at? Yes, but they argue that they're selling it at a higher price, essentially as a pass-through of the higher crude oil price that they have to pay for their supplies.
Right. Well, far be it for me to defend ExxonMobil, but I think there is some truth in what they're saying. The cost of recovery are increasing.
Right. I understand the cost of recovery is increasing, and the cost of processing is increasing, mm-hmm. and the cost at the pump is increasing.
Right.
My question is, why are profits also increasing?
Well, I think the other side of that is they know that they're in a business that's not going to be in existence in another 10 or 20 years.
Right.
And they are trying to extract everything they can in terms of profits so they can perpetuate the company and move on to the next thing.
Oh, I see. So you're saying it's not just it's an extractive industry, not just in the sense of extracting products from the world, but in extracting money from customers.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, and so that they can get into solar energy or whatever they feel like, or real estate at a later date.
That's right. No organization wants to turn the key and go out of business, so they're clearly looking to the next opportunity. And probably something in energy. ExxonMobil is a little bit different from BP, a little bit different from Shell. ExxonMobil, I think, my opinion is they're a little bit more less ecology friendly, less in a number of ways, forthcoming about what they're doing with that money. And of course, if they see an opportunity, they're going to take it, because they will simply say, whatever people are willing to pay is what we have a right to charge.
Right, and they may, for example, General Electric owns NBC. There's no reason why they couldn't buy the New York Times if they
felt. Right, and if consumers would stop driving during the summer,
right,
significantly, I'm sure the price would go down some. But people aren't doing that, and so they're saying, well, we can sell at this price.
Yeah, essentially, it's taking all that the market will bear.
Yes.
Okay, talk about healthcare. It's obviously a huge, complicated, and difficult subject, but where does U.S. healthcare stand now in relation to the rest of the world, both for the people who can afford the best and those that can't, at this time?
Well, of course, you have the clinical side, that is when people get sick and get treatment. Then you have the public health side. The public health side in America is largely ignored. actually you have 50 different, plus the Washington, D.C. Each of those entities has a different type of public health system. There's no national public health system, although the federal government gives money, and there's the CDC, and they can sometimes exert their jurisdiction and come in. But basically it's run at the state and local levels. And so here where I am in Pennsylvania, the per capita spending is near the bottom. It's right around 49th or 50th every year. Next door in New York, it's near the top. So you're going to find, in Ohio is higher, you're going to find a great difference in the public health infrastructure from state to state, just to get that on the table.
Okay. Now, go ahead.
Well, the threat of peak oil is that you have to look at the entire country as a system, and that I'd say to people, peak oil is going to introduce chaos into the system. And by that I mean everything is going to become scarce because oil is so involved with everything. People could lose jobs. There will be less oil for transportation, for products. All of these things will reverberate. And plus, you can have increased susceptibility to disease and illnesses if people, because energy costs are so high, have to choose between eating and heating their home, they're probably going to choose not to heat the home. Decisions like that.
Or in California, between cooling their home and eating.
Because the South and Southwest are greatly imperiled by this also.
More than 100 people have died in the Central Valley in the last week from heat-related causes.
Yes. Okay. So the implications for public health are, just in this country and also worldwide, are enormous, I think. And on the clinical side, the so-called healthcare crisis, peak oil is going to solve that, not in a wonderful way, but there's no way the system currently eating up 16% of the gross domestic product and the inflation that is built in with, that's not going to be possible if we go into a depression or a recession, which peak oil is probably going to create.
So, in fact, the energy situation is rather fragile, and the healthcare situation is rather fragile, and
yes,
their intersection is doubly fragile, or
yes,
exponentially fragile.
Yes, it is. And it's interesting that when I have these discussions with people, some people say, oh, that'll never happen, and you say, why? And they say, well, it can't happen. Or some people say, oh, my God, you know, I never thought about that. That's really got me worried.
Okay, well, talk a little bit about the general parameters of these institutional impediments to seeing and dealing with the issues we've just outlined.
Well, just in general, any society is conservative by nature. I think we all know that. That what's there, people tend to assume, is the institutions and the ways you have of doing things are the best ways. And maybe you tinker with improving it, but basically it's the best way to do things. And, of course, people usually use the word bureaucracy to complain that things don't change, or for what seem like very stupid and asinine decisions, nonsensical decisions. Well, that's the way things work. And then when a threat comes along, the more radical the solution the threat requires, the more people are going to be, at the psychological level, engaging in denial and refusal to deal with the threat. And that is what I think absolutely is going on in the healthcare sectors regarding peak oil. Most people do not want to deal with it. I have to say there are a good number, maybe 20-30%, who do understand it and care about it, but they have no idea what to do about it.
Okay. You've written a paper, not being published yet, that calls for the creation of energy and health centers.
Right.
On the model of the MIT Energy Research Council.
Right.
Which I've looked into it since I read that paper.
Mm-hmm.
To tell our listeners what the MIT Energy Research Council is, and then we can talk about the energy and health centers.
Yeah, I'll be quick. MIT is very interesting because they're a techie school, and most techies just ignore energy. They just assume it's going to be there, and they're going to get to the moon or Mars, Uranus. MIT is different. They're a techie school, but they also understand energy. And so they have brought this unique combination of the techiness plus the understanding, oh my gosh, we've got an energy crisis coming, and they have said, we want to be the leader. Now they certainly believe that technology will save us. At least most of them do, not all of them. They do believe that. Nonetheless, They do discuss peak oil. They do acknowledge the threat. And they said, we're going to be the Institute of Higher Education that is going to lead the way in looking for replacements for fossil fuels. That's my understanding of what they're doing.
And also practice what they preach and essentially recreate themselves as a sustainable energy community.
Yeah. They refer to it, as you know in the paper, walking the talk.
Right.
And so I have outlined that in this call that I sent to several deans of schools of public health and said, here is a university, and everybody knows who and what MIT is, and they are taking this issue absolutely seriously, and this is a model for which medical schools and schools of public health should look at to do their own version of walking the talk.
And in fact, what can be borrowed from the MIT model is that at the least, they're going to try to make themselves more survivable,
yes.
And at the best, they're going to become a fountainhead of ideas and products and intellectual property and make a lot of money solving the problem of the energy of peak oil around the world.
That's what they hope. I'm not sure, in my heart of hearts, I'm not sure that's going to happen. But another ramification of peak oil is that a lot of institutions, like institutions of higher education, if it gets really bad, they're going to disappear because most people are going to be concerned with eating and they're going to be involved in agriculture and keeping warm during the winter. I'm being a little bit grim, but I think I'm being realistic about what could happen.
Okay, talk more about the energy and health centers that you proposed on the model of what MIT is doing.
All right. Well, energy is acknowledged in public health. If you look at the public health textbooks, it's acknowledged, but only in a paragraph or two, as being vital to the existence and the complexity level of a society. They all say that. But there's nothing more said about it. And so there's...
Because it's assumed the status quo is going to continue into the indefinite future.
We've lived in a society that has been energy abundant. We have treated it profligately. It's been there. It's been cheap. Nobody cares. You know, American graffiti, cars...
But this has only been the case... The first oil well in the United States, Alfred... was drilled in Titusville, Pennsylvania in 1859.
That's right.
So it's really been a little more than 150, hasn't been 150 years since the petroleum age has begun.
Right, and really somewhere in the 20s or 30s is when it really got going.
Right.
And of course the Texas boom and all that. So the public health and medicine, they need to for the first time, study what energy is, how energy is related to the health of a population, to the economy, and of course, they're going to have to do a lot of educating, which really, in some cases, amounts to propagandizing, but educating the public, just like they did about germs 100 years ago, when the microbe was discovered.
Right.
And so what I'm saying to people is, there's a book called The Gospel of Germs. We need centers that are going to develop and preach the gospel of energy.
So essentially you're saying that the revolution in personal hygiene is at the same scale as the revolution in understanding and use of
Absolutely.
Energy has to be.
I think there is no way, given what I know, and I may not know everything, but I think given what I know and those who I trust, who I read and listen to, there's no way the level of energy consumption this society is at now is sustainable. It simply is sustainable. I think we've reached the limits to growth. Let me just say that.
So is the question, as far as you're concerned, one of finding substitutes or of reducing consumption?
I don't think adequate substitutes, this is my opinion, I don't think adequate substitutes are going to be found. I think, yes, substitutes have to be found because oil is going to disappear and so is natural gas and coal, which we shouldn't even be using, I think, the coal, but so it's a combination of conservation, substitutes, but with the full realization that our level of consumption is going to have to be reduced. And this comes back to a basic value of American society, which is individualism, because that, I think, is behind the massive consumption of energy. We consume, one-fourth of all the energy in the world?
Right. And that's based on living in the suburbs, driving a car in, and driving a car out, just on the simple level of not using public transportation, but individual cars burning oil.
Yes, and if you look at hospitals,
right,
the enormous amounts of energy that are consumed in hospitals, prosthetic energy too, to do things that people used to do. I talked to someone recently whose father is a retired physician, and he said, most doctors don't even learn how to set a bone anymore. Some machine does it for them.
Right.
It's becoming a lost art. So it's all those things.
Let's talk specifically about the creation of energy in health centers. What are you doing in that area? Who's responding? How close to having some of these around are you?
There were, in January, I sent an inquiry to all 37 deans of public health and sent them a summary of the paper I delivered at the annual meetings in December in Philadelphia. And six of them wrote back and said, you have identified a serious problem. Keep me informed. And the rest, I heard nothing from them. But that's pretty good to hear from 6 of 37.
That's right. And okay. Yeah, go ahead.
And then I kept writing and doing things. I spoke at Ohio State at the end of April, and currently I'm working with a colleague from Ohio State, the School of Public Health, on preparing a proposal that we may submit to Ohio State. We haven't decided for sure yet, but we may submit it to them. But we're working on a proposal, and I have sent this proposal to five other schools of public health.
The people who responded?
Yes, and I'm waiting to hear. Usually, I don't hear from some of them. I heard back from one, and he said, Dan, I'm with you on this, but I am so pessimistic, it's just going to take a crisis to get anybody to put any money up. But that's what he said to me.
Okay. In terms of the proposed institutional structure, you're talking about setting this up at Ohio State and having other schools of public health sort of become associate members, or you're talking about a national consortium that would have multiple sites? What kind of structure are you envisioning?
My original idea was for a national consortium.
Right.
And I proposed that to them in March, and none of them were interested. Now I have tried to make the case a bit stronger and say every school of public health should consider having one of these, and they should collaborate with each other. Because there's always that competitiveness.
Now, since MIT is already moving in the direction you'd like to see in general, there's a sister institution there. Harvard has a school of public health.
Yes, there is.
MIT and Harvard work together a lot of the time. Yes. Is there some possibility there of essentially getting Harvard's public health school and MIT's Energy Council to get together and build something there in that regard?
Harvard is one of the schools that contacted me when I sent the paper in December or January, and the dean said, this is important. So I have sent this subsequent paper to him just about 2 weeks ago.
Right.
I didn't suggest it to him, but, I mean, he knows his town.
Right.
And I think there's a chance because they are forward-looking. However, I don't know how the institution really runs, except that they like to start off with a big pot of money rather than seeding things. This is going to have to be seeded because there are a lot of skeptics and doubters out there, but whoever does this first is going to be very happy because in 2 years, when it really hits the fan, I think they're going to say, oh my God, this was such a, I'm so happy that our school is leading the way on this, that we started this. That's when the money will come. That's when the attention will come, and it could come sooner. It could come, I mean, I really don't know when this is going to happen, whether it will be gradual or something sudden.
Well, it seemed to me that when an emergency room is overwhelmed with people who are dying from heat, from having no air conditioning, that ought to call, that ought to focus people's attention on it.
It should. But the other thing about public health is much of it is driven by government funding.
Right.
And a lot of these schools, 80% of their faculty salaries come from government grants. So they study what the request for proposals say they should study, nothing more.
Now, if you have two oil men running the executive branch of the federal government and their party in charge in Congress, what's the likelihood that you're going to get public policy and funding that contradicts their worldview?
There is a peak oil caucus in Congress.
Right.
The Udalls, the cousins, the Udalls.
Right.
I forget their names. And someone named Roscoe Bartlett, who you may have heard of.
I've got to call into his scheduler to do an interview with him.
Well, he's a wonderful man. He's Republican. He fully, in my opinion, he fully understands the energy predicament. I asked him a question at a conference in in May and said, what's going to happen to health care? And the room went silent. I'm not exaggerating because I asked some other people there. The room went silent. And then people said, oh, my God. And he said, believe me, this Ferrari health care system we have will not survive peak oil. So he's very interested, very concerned. I think he's an ally. At the right time, one can go to that kind of an ally if one has other people. I've contacted Al Gore and Senator Kennedy just recently. I haven't heard back from him yet. And I'm contacting a lot of people just saying, here's an issue, and here are two things that need to be brought together, the health care issue and what peak oil is going to do to it.
Now, could you just paint with broad strokes what you think the policy ought to be after all of these institutions are set up and all these studies are done? You may have already have some idea about what they ought to be recommending.
I think they have to be really practice, education, training oriented. We really don't have the time. I would love to do it, you know, to do these nice little esoteric studies where you look up somebody's ideas. I don't think we have that kind of time.
Okay, well, in a short time here in the interview, tell us what you think the policy ought to be.
I think we need to immediately start educating the public about the health implications of energy, that is, not having sufficient energy. And then we need to start, healthcare needs to start being a good citizen. And frankly, I think what's coming is the depoliticization of global warming and the peak oil issue, and just say, look, slavery used to be a political issue, and so was women's suffrage. But nobody argues that as politics anymore. This is going to be the same kind of thing. We have to protect populations, or we face a die-off, a population die-off. That's the kind of education that needs to be done, and it's all there in the literature, except a lot of it's not in public health, or where it is in public health, it's like in Australia or England, but not in America, but in earth sciences and demography and, those kindred kind of disciplines, there's all the information we need to put this together and make the case. Public health is great at educating people, and that's what it should be doing about energy.
Okay. Tell people who want to get more information from you how they can do that.
Well, they can just type peak oil, public health on their browser, and they'll find me because I'm the only one writing about this. They'll find my email address. They'll find me and my papers.
Okay, good. I want any final things you want to say about this?
Well, no. I think everyone who's listening should speak to someone in medicine or healthcare about this issue to raise awareness. That's what I would say.
During the 30 seconds they have with their physician, they should take some of the time to do this.
That's right. We'll write a paper and hand it to them.
Okay, good. Thank you very much for talking to us today on Utopia Media.
Okay.